You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
No, not a man, not a human being. I'm a complex space-time event. I am Lord President of Gallifrey, the traveler from beyond time. I am the Sandman, the oncoming storm. I am the Kar-Farak Gatri, destroyer of worlds. And sometimes, only sometimes, I am your worst nightmare. I'm the Doctor, and I take care of my friends.
Welcome to The Oncoming Storm, your podcast about the Doctor Who you won't see on television. Featuring Josh Wilson, Ashley Rayburn, Rachel Stewart, and Jeff Polier. From books, audios, comics, and beyond, we're your source for all things Doctor Who spin-off media.
Greetings once again, everyone. Welcome to The Oncoming Storm, your Doctor Who spin-off media podcast where we talk about everything Doctor Who that you won't find on television. From books to audios to comics, we cover everything that you don't see on television. I am one of your hosts, Josh Wilson, and tonight I am fortunate enough to be joined by Ashley Rayburn and Jeff Polier. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
And before everybody starts getting upset and thinking that, oh my God, what has Josh done to Rachel? Rachel couldn't be here tonight. This is the same reason that kept her off a couple of episodes ago. The personal issues, is she's still having to deal with some stuff like that. So she's going to be taking a little bit of time off. She will be back. Don't worry. I haven't killed her like I did some other previous hosts of the podcast. So...
And like you probably will me, I'm constantly looking over my shoulder.
I'm really fortunate enough to live on the other side of the country.
No, it's all good. And we are thinking of you, Rachel, and hopefully there will be no complications in the future, and we'll be hearing from her sooner rather than later. So
there'll be no trouble at all.
Well, there is some news that we'll talk about in a little bit that'll bring her back for sure.
Well, maybe. One would hope. We'll see. I don't know. We're just a couple of months away from talking about Doom Coalition 2, so I figure if nothing else, that'll lure her back. But that's in a couple of months. First off, how's everybody doing tonight? The ones I do have here.
Yeah, I'm doing well. You know, it's...
Are you actually... You're bohemian lifestyle, not too much for you these days?
Yeah, so the problem with my bohemian lifestyle is I can't have it anymore. And... I took a job that has to be responsible. And
that's your problem right there.
I know. So bohemian lifestyle isn't so bohemian anymore. It's taken me a little bit of time to get used to that. The problem is my house still reflects the bohemian lifestyle. So that's the part that has to change.
Oh, our little Ashley's growing up. Oh, that's so sweet. Look, dude, I've had kids for more years than I care to admit to nowadays, and my house still looks like it has the bohemian lifestyle. It's not going to get any easier, believe me.
At least you can kind of you not so much, but at least you can kind of blame it on your kids. I can't do that yet. Like, they look and it's like, okay, you're obviously still living like you're 20 and you turn 35 in a few weeks. So, my collecting is a little out of hand. Not the buying. It's just like the stuff that I already have. Like, there's no place for it. So, yeah, I'm using, apparently, the podcast to let off steam I didn't know I had. That's about myself. It's nothing to do with anyone else. It's just me.
Well, I'm glad we're useful to you, Ashley. At least you'll keep coming back.
Cheap therapy.
It's cheap, all right.
All right. Let us get into some news, because after having a couple of quiet weeks, we've had some big announcements from the Big Finish camp, as they are wont to do. And we'll start off with probably not the one you're thinking of, but the one that I'm going to list first. So you're just going to have to deal with it. The first story that I want to talk about is the announcement of course, the next Bernie Summerfield box set, The New Adventures of Bernie Summerfield. And you might think that, oh, good, we've got Benny and the Seventh Doctor and Ace back again. That's what I thought when I first said the headline. But no, it is something completely different. Because this time, Bernie Summerfield will be traveling to a alternate universe and meeting the Unbound Doctor, as played by David Warner.
Now,
you may remember this Doctor from his audios Sympathy for the Devil and Masters of War. The idea behind his Unbound Doctor is that he is a doctor who did not go back to UNIT in the 70s and therefore was not around to fight all of the alien invasions that happened along there. He shows up much later and meets a much more jaded brigadier who has had to live through all of this nightmare on Earth. And this doctor is a doctor that is much more cautious and isn't quite as ready to jump into things as his previous incarnations, because it didn't work out so well for him back during his Troughton era. So, unfortunately, of course, the previous two stories that David Warner was in as this doctor featured Nicholas Courtney as the Brigadier, and he will not be around, unfortunately, sadly, but someone who is making a return to join Benny and this doctor is Mark Gatiss, who portrayed the Master in Sympathy for the Devil, spoiler alert. extra spoiler alert, because he was actually credited as Sam Kisgaard rather than Mark Gatiss, doing the old Anthony Ainley switch around his name so that we don't know that it's the Master. So, yeah, he will be back portraying the Master. And so, as the blurb says, New Adventures of Bernie Summerfield, Volume 3, The Unbound Universe, will see the universe's greatest archaeologist. Even Big Finish is saying that Benny is the universe's greatest archaeologist, just pointing that out. We'll see the universe's greatest archaeologist recruited by the Doctor for a mission to his parallel dimension, where together they set off to explore the aftermath of a disaster that has laid waste to reality. Benny and the Doctor will face the Kareem, the Blanks, Unicorns, and the Sisters of St. Belix as a terrible truth awaits them at the end of reality. So, we've got David Warner and Lisa Bauman together. I will miss Sylvester, of course. I guess they needed him to go do something else, and so decided that they needed to get somebody to replace him, and they figured that David Warner might...
So, is this like our Benny?
This is our Benny, crossing universes to go meet the Unbound Doctor. Think of it as, I don't know, like a Secret Wars, Elseworld type appearance as she crosses over, you know, multiversity type of thing.
I think this sounds terrific. I mean, I'm glad we finally get another story with the David Warner version of the Doctor, because he is an amazing actor.
Yes.
And just, you know, whether he's on screen or just audio, that voice of his is just wonderful.
Certainly. And Big Finish has been very lucky. They've gotten a lot of David Warner over the last couple of years. He has really come out and done a lot of work for them here recently.
Well, he's been a villain in The Fourth Doctor.
Yes.
The second season of The Fourth. And I think he came back.
Well, you're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, Ashley. We'll get to that in a minute. But
oh, that's right. That's right. No, he hasn't come. That's right. No, but I think he's come back since then, and I guess
yes.
he's coming back.
Yes,
again.
He has come back a couple of times there, and he was just in a story. He was just in the War Doctor set too.
Oh, that's right. The one the one we just listened to.
Well, the second War Doctor
set.
The second
one. All right.
So he was just in that. So yeah, he's doing a lot of work, and he was obviously the breakout hit from those Unbound stories enough to where. Well, they also brought back the Doctor that never left Gallifrey for a second story. But you got David Warner playing the Doctor. Of course, people are going to flock to that, and why wouldn't they want to do that again? Mm-hmm. And so yeah, it's pretty exciting to see. I'm interested to see how they work this out to where he decides he's going to come after Benny for assistance, or maybe it's just happenstance that he gets Benny and then they go off on the adventures. It'll be exciting at the very least, because if nothing else, being an alternate universe, they could do whatever the heck they want to it without having to worry about repercussions. And actually kind of sounds like that's already happened. Evidently, reality has gone haywire in this universe. They can do whatever they want to. And those are always fun stories to listen to. So I'll tell you what. Let's go ahead and skip our second story while we're on the David Warner train here, because who really cares about the second story anyway? And let's talk about our third story on the list, Tom Baker. Why don't you give us the what's happening there, Ashley?
The final story in the fifth season, the fifth box set, or the fifth season of Tom Baker. The Tom Baker audios, and we do get to see Cuthbert again, and he is once again played by, as they say, national treasure David Warner.
Yes.
and of course, the last time we saw him was in the final phase, and you got to see him do some different things. I don't think there's not a blurb in this, is there?
Well, no, I mean, they give a little bit of the backstory about how the first story they're running into Cuthbert again, as well as somebody else.
Oh, and Mr. Doric, which is Toby Hadoke. I always liked his character in that.
And somebody else.
I'm looking. I haven't had a chance to look at this yet. We're professionals.
Some of us are.
we're not professionals. Professionals get paid.
This is true. There is no payment going on here. And also we have the Black Guardian showing up. And he is played by David Troughton, which should be really interesting to see. I love it when they bring David Troughton, and he's done a lot of stuff for Big Finish.
And of course, they are teasing a deadly encounter that somebody from the TARDIS crew is going to die.
Dun, dun, dun.
I know.
Adric. Oh, too late.
I don't think Adric's around.
He's not on the TARDIS crew. So this is Romana.
It's just wishful thinking.
The Doctor and K-9. So John Leeson playing K-9.
They do have the synopses up, actually, if you'd like to read them, if you want to click on the stories.
I don't see.
Just click where it says The Pursuit of History. And you can read the synopses there. I know.
Look at that.
It's tricky, isn't it?
I clicked the wrong thing. No, I did. There's no...
I'm looking at The Pursuit of History right now.
Oh, there wasn't one for casualties.
No, there's one for
Okay, that's where
history.
I was. Okay. Yeah, on a brisk winter's morning in 1850s Yorkshire, Cuthbert, head of the intergalactic business known as the Conglomerate, prepares to hijack a very special train. Ooh, that already sounds fun. In the far future, his assistant, Mr. Doric, is awoken by howling alarms. There's a problem within the quantum gateway. In the TARDIS, the Doctor, Romana, and K-9 detect strange distortions in the vortex. An energy stream coming from a strange creature called the Lon. Oh, so the Lon are back.
Yep.
The threads of a plan centuries in the making are coming together, but who is behind the plan, and can anyone possibly escape when history is against them?
Holy crap, Ashley, did you write this story? Because it sounds like you could have.
Yeah, except...
Except there's no Ice Warriors.
Well, possibly. I guess I'm like the only one, because I hear a lot of people that really like those stories with Delon and all that, but I didn't... They were all right. So I hope this is, and I really do like the Tom Baker stories. I'm actually a huge fan of that line. But those were stories that just kind of bleh. But I do like the fact that this is going to incorporate time travel and a hijack of a special train and howling alarms. You know, it has all the right things. It has my favorite Romana. And, of course, K-9 and Tom Baker. So, yeah, it'll be pretty great. I failed to see how I could have written this, but...
it just seems like it ticked all your boxes there.
It ticks a lot of them. That's true. Except for the fact that it takes place in the past, some of it.
Well, it's all futury past, right? Connected and outer space hijinks, that sort of thing.
Yes, but the past.
All right, so that's Tom Baker. Okay, fine, Jeff. We can talk about the other big story.
Well big-ish.
Big-ish from Big Finish. And again, I'm sorry Rachel isn't here to talk about this herself, because this would be her favorite story of the day. Diary of River Song, Series 2, coming in a year. Oh my gosh, not till January 2017.
I think it'll take us that long to be able to talk about that.
Hopefully tempers have calmed by then.
Some time to let things heal.
But yes, faithful listeners, Alex Kingston, it will be reprising her role as River Song for audio again. And this time, not Paul McGann, but Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy will be guest starring in this box set.
Yeah, I guess they didn't take my suggestions to heart from last episode.
Well, it may have had something to do with how you presented them. So it says, from the space exploration vessel Saturnius, which is heading to a destination that never gets any closer, to a doomed planet Earth and beyond, River's journey will bring her closer to a new foe and an encounter with both the Sixth and Seventh Doctors. And I'm thrilled. Of course, I'm thrilled. I thought the series one of Diary River Song was terrific. Looking forward to listening to what they do next year for series two.
I will say this. These synopses for these stories sound incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, I absolutely love them. Even in the first set. I mean, they have these great synopses. They have, I mean, really fun trailers. I do think this one has a lot more potential for me than a lot of the other things that we talked about last time. And if anyone's interested in that, you can go back and revisit that. I'm not touching it. But I do think they do a really good job with these synopses. So I'm anxious to see how it turns out. And you know, it does have Sylvester. It does have Colin. It'll be fun to see how it plays out. Or it will be for me.
Well, and it has, you know, they list.
And I will say that Rachel called that. She basically was pretty sure that they would put her with the Seventh Doctor.
Well, I mean, of course they're going to, because they want to sell things.
I see the correlation in that.
Because it's they want to see her. People want to see her meet the other doctors. I mean, fine, whatever. I still stand by what I said last time.
Those people would still buy a box set.
I agree. I agree. I think that audience would buy it anyway. And I think, again, that you're still doing the character River Song a disfavor by constantly putting her up against these doctors that you can't satisfy. They're nothing but a series of, I want to use a stronger word, but teases that are never going to end up paying off, really, because she can't really meet them. And again, you're making the character all about the doctor when she is good enough to stand alone. Spoiler alert, I will say, as you'll find out in a couple of months, her appearance in Doom Coalition works much better for me than what happened in Diary of River Song. So it is possible for her to be used quite well. I will say it for about the 500th time over the last 2 weeks. I don't hate River Song. I just think the box set didn't do any favors. And I'm worried by constantly putting with the doctor, but at the same time, the people that they have writing these stories are the best people that Big Finish have.
There's going to be four more stories, and I presume a fifth disc with special features again. The four stories are The Unknown by Guy Adams, 529 by John Dorney, World Enough in Time by James Goss, and Eye of the Storm by Matt Fitton.
I mean, if you had to have me name the four people who are currently working at Big Finish to write the best stories, these are the four names I would give you. Absolutely brilliant writers. And the fact that they're sticking them in this box set that I want to be like, no, I don't want any interest in it. I have to because they are so good. So I have to hope that they live up to the reputation that I'm giving to them and will do this box set right. So,
well, I'm going to presume that one of the stories has a Suntaran in it because the guest cast includes Dan Starkey.
I don't know. They're sticking him in everything these days. So
he's doing a lot of non-Suntaran stuff, too, though.
Is he? Okay.
As I recall, I saw him in something that I was like, that doesn't have a Suntaran in it. I don't remember what it was.
Now, buried in this new story behind the lead of River's Return is there are also two additional announcements that we will be having Ian McNeice back in the Churchill Years Volume 2, as well as a second box set of Classic Doctors New Monsters. That Volume 2 will also be out in 2017.
Have they announced any information about that?
I do not believe that they have announced anything as far as who is going to be it as of yet. So, I mean, I imagine you expect to have, you know, 5, 6, 7, and 8 Doctors in it, but no indication of what the new series Monsters will be. Honestly, I don't know where they can really go from here.
I'm really curious. I would love to see them get a Tom Baker ones.
Maybe.
Do a Tom Baker one. I mean, it would just be, I mean, because he doesn't really do those things like, oh, the other Doctors are doing it, I'm not going to do it.
I feel like the only other iconic monster that the new series has given us is the Silence, and that would be kind of hard to do, at least storyline-wise.
Well, I mean, you could always do non-iconic monsters.
The whole concept of the Silence is that you forget them, so I guess they could do it and just have the Doctor forget them. That's actually wouldn't be that difficult to do, I imagine. So,
following the link, it just says a lot of to be announced.
Right.
The series will be directed by Barnaby Edwards. The script editor's Matt Fitton. So, yeah, nothing to go on yet. You can already pre-order it if you want to. Yeah. But they don't even have a date yet. It's just to be announced.
Yeah, I mean, I'm racking my brain trying to think of any other monster that stands out from the new series.
The
Wire. No.
Well, like maybe the cat people from New
Earth. Okay.
You know,
maybe the cat people.
But what? I mean, there's nothing that really makes them differentiate themselves from Audio. You could have the cat people from Survival.
Well, and also, you know, I'm reluctant to call some of the aliens we see monsters because, you know, they just because they're alien does not make them a monster.
Now, I would like to see the Doctor in the Shadow Proclamation. If you did a whole season the Shadow Proclamation, like Doctor Who.
You in that Shadow Proclamation.
I would like that to finally pay off.
Or
the one Doctor time we visit the Shadow Proclamation was so disappointing.
Doctor Who and the Galactic Federation meet the Shadow Proclamation. There you go. God. That would be like the best thing ever.
Oh,
it's okay. What Doctor Who was made for.
Oh, sure. That's exactly what I think of when I think of Doctor Who.
Also, the thing about the Churchill years, Jeff, have you listened to that? I know you were really looking forward to the first
volume one. Yeah. It was,
so do you think it? Good. Do you think it really merits a second one?
I think it did well enough, and there's certainly...
I mean, I'm not talking about, like, doing well enough or paying or, you know, them making money on it. My question is, do you think do you think there's more story to tell that way?
Yeah, certainly.
I'm not listening to it.
World War II and, you know, even the decades before and after it are such a rich storytelling environment that... And Churchill is such an important historical figure, love him or hate him, or both. That I can certainly see more stories involving the Doctors and Churchill. Yeah.
Well, I know. I still haven't listened to the first one. I'm not rushing out of all the stuff I got to listen to. I'm sure, like, it's perfectly fine. It's just
like almost any box set, it's a mixed bag. There's one I didn't really enjoy that much at all, but the other three range from good to great. Well, so
I mean, it's no Dalek Empire, but
but well, then no, what
it's,
is?
It's not that bad.
I'll go to the mat for you. Actually, Dalek Empire is good. It was good stuff. Well, for the most part. Okay.
Well, the first disc was good.
The first year's Dalek Empire is pretty good.
Moving on.
All right. So moving on, we have some new trailers out from Big Finish. If you must go get a taste of David Tennant, they have a new trailer out for the Tenth Doctor Adventures. Of course, we've got three releases coming in May: Technophobia, Time Reaver, and Death and the Queen. So you can go check out, and they had released a little teaser a couple of months ago. But this one is the first full trailer coming out in a couple of months. And then they've also put out a new trailer for Gallifrey Enemy Lines, a much more exciting, to me, release featuring Lala Ward as Romana 2, and, of course, Louise Jameson as Leela, and Sophie Aldred as Ace. And we've got Narvin and Brax in there as well. They have been hesitant to confirm on sequel, prequel to Interdimension Earth that came out last year. So I would imagine with the end of that story involving some timey-wimey shenanigans going on with what was going on with Omega, I would expect that this could potentially be both a prequel and a sequel as we get a resolution to that storyline. So,
timey-wimey.
Yes, timey-wimey. Both of those are out in May. You can check out the trailers there, as well as the nifty new cover for Enemy Lines, featuring a nice skeletal Time Lord there on the cover, as time runs out for Gallifrey.
I'm looking forward to this, but I really want another Gallifrey story with Juliet Landau.
Well, I almost expect that she is going to have at least some sort of minimal presence in the story, even though it's not advertised.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the last one that she was in, when she was the main focus, ended in quite a large cliffhanger that we would assume is going to be resolved in this story. And so I would imagine at least a cameo from her would be hopefully there to kind of wrap things up. But we'll see. And then, of course, I assume if it still does as well as it does, it'll lead to even more down the line. But who knows? Speaking of releases, of course, we kind of mentioned it. Doom Coalition is now out. It came out last week. So if you haven't had a chance, rush and go get it. Doom Coalition is keeping up its track record as being better than Dark Eyes. So that's what I'll say for now until we cover it in full in a couple of months. All right. So I think that does it with Big Finish. Ashley, the next story looks like it is right up your alley. We talked about one of these a couple of months ago.
And yeah, so this is, we were talking about these Choose the Future books, which is like the old Choose Your Own Adventure books and Choose Your Fate, things like that, where you kind of go through and you read a page and it says if you want to take the left corridor, you go to page 57. If you want to get in the TARDIS and leave Clara behind, go to page 120. So this is the 12th Doctor, and it is called Terror Moon. In this brand new adventure, Terror Moon, the 12th Doctor travels to a far-off moon base only to discover a monstrous, flesh-eating horror living in wait. There you go. And, of course, you decide how, when, where, and with whom the Doctor will fight to save the world. The fate of the universe is in your hands. And this is put out by Penguin Books, which put out a lot of these kind of younger reader books. And I love the cover of this. It's got a real, like, retro-looking cover. So I don't know. I mean, it sounds fun. Like we said before, this isn't something that's new. It's something that they've done before. back in the Sixth Doctor era, they did two or three, I think three, of these books. And one of these days, we might just go through one.
Yeah, maybe. That'd be fun.
If we ever all find our books or get the books or whatever. So
I don't have any Choose Your Adventure ones, unfortunately. And I realized I actually saw somebody on Facebook post a picture of all of them. There was more than I thought. They did like five of them.
Oh, did they do five? I knew that for some reason three was in my head.
Yeah, there was like
five. I used to have like five copies of one of them. And if that were the case, if I could find them, I'd send them out to everyone. But
this is being written by Trevor Baxendale, who has done a lot of work for BBC Books in the past. So I'm actually kind of looking forward to this one. Choose Your Own Adventure style books. If we can't get the other ones, we'll definitely do one of these new ones, I think, just to check it out, because that'd be fun. So that's a Time Gate episode if there's nothing else.
So these will be a lot of fun.
All right.
I don't know.
Well, we'll find out, won't we? At some point in time in the future. I do want to touch on a product that I was greatly looking forward to that is now officially out. The Black Archive, a series of books from Obverse, where they are doing detailed analysis on individual episodes or stories from the breadth of Doctor Who's history. The first four of those have now been released. You can get them physical copies or on ebook. By going to Obverse Books website. Of course, the first four are Rose is by John Arnold. The second one is The Massacre by James Corey Smith. The third one is The Ambassadors of Death by Ellen Miles. And then the last one is Dark Water, Death in Heaven by Philip Purser Hallard. I'm really looking forward to that one. So you can go get those now and check them out. And I'll let you know once I get – I'm definitely going to get the Dark Water, Death in Heaven one to see how it goes and just get an idea of what they're doing there. Because I think there will be a lot of interesting things to look at as far as just in-depth analysis on – because kind of what we do, right? We take a single story and go and do some in-depth analysis. So I'm interested to see what they have to say here, especially with the writers that got lined up for here and in the future. So go check those out. And our last story also is a little bit book-related. Either one of you?
Next to last.
Oh, okay, yes, next to last. Okay. Ashley, you want to talk a little bit about this?
They are doing an art exhibit with Target novel covers, original art, original paintings that feature Andrew Skilleter, Jeff Cummins, Roy Knipe, Tony Mazzaro, and of course the first artist of the range, Chris Achilles, and that's just to name a few. And this is going to give people a chance to see the original paintings of many of these covers. And I think this is fascinating. And this is at the Cartoon Museum, which I believe is that in London?
Yeah, it is in London.
Yeah. And it's like it's over 50 pieces, I think. Or actually, this says 30 pieces. The other article said 50. That's weird. It's going to be lots of these covers, which I think is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Specifically the Chris Achilles books. I think his is the most memorable of that range, because then you get into like the photos and those photo covers and things like that.
Yeah, and I do know that they were looking to track down anybody that happened to have any pieces of original art of any of these covers. A lot of them have been sold over the years, and they were putting the word out if you had them to get in touch for trying to work something out along those lines. This is going to run from April 28th through May 11th. So if you're in the area, go check that out, because that'd be a pretty cool thing to go see, I think.
Yeah, that'd be a really neat thing to see. Specifically, I mean, some of this art, I mean, there's no way. If you're into the art side of Doctor Who, this is definitely the way to see that, some of the more classic art that, you know, you're not going to see every day.
Mm-hmm. And that takes us to our last story. What you got there for us, Jeff?
Well, this one is very personal to me because I'm in it. So the Doctor Who audio dramas is a fan series of audio plays like Big Finish does. They've been going since 1982. And my wife, JJ, and I are in the story that's being released this month titled Xylon Rebellion. The trailer is already up and available. The release of the story, it's a 4-part story. I'm not sure if they can release all 4 at once. Usually it's 1 at a time, but the release date is 17th March. So this month, you can find Doctor Who Audio Dramas on Facebook. Their web presence is dwad.net. And yeah, I play Jim Horton, whose Earth has been invaded, and he's... he's kind of a collaborator. You know, he's working with the aliens in order to get preferential treatment for his family.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Anything else? How was it working on one of those? How did that whole process go? Just give us a little behind the scenes.
Well, it was really, you know, singular. You know, we're not going to a studio because the people involved are just all over the place. So I had my script. I recorded my lines at home, and then they get emailed in and edited into one cohesive story. Nice. So, you know, I recorded my lines, JJ recorded her lines, and we'll finally have a chance to hear the finished story. I actually have links so I can listen to it ahead of time. I just got those last night, though, so I haven't actually heard it. I did hear the trailer. I'm in the trailer, so that's pretty exciting.
Awesome. Looking forward to that. Excellent. Excellent, Jeff. That's very exciting. It's good to hear.
And so maybe we'll review that in an upcoming episode.
Ooh, that would be fun, now, wouldn't it?
And it's certainly a story that everyone can afford because it's free.
The best price there is.
Yes.
All right. I think, does that do it for news? Anybody have anything that we missed? Are we ready to move along to our feature presentation?
Alonzi? Oh, wrong doctor. Sorry.
All right. Well, let's do it. So, of course, tonight... we are talking about our next Virgin New Adventure, Head Games by Steve Lyons. I'm going to read the back just to give you a little bit of taste before we go into spoiler-filled territory. The blurb reads, "This isn't hell," the Doctor assured her. "It's only a sequel. Stand by for an exciting new adventure with Doctor Who and his companion Jason. Once again, our time-hopping friends set out to seek injustice, raise rebel armies, overthrow dictators, and beat up green monsters. But this time, Doctor Who faces a deadly new threat. A genocidal rogue Time Lord and his army of combat-hardened, gunslinging warrior women. To make matters worse, this foe is a twisted version of the good Doctor himself. And if Doctor Who and Jason can't stop him, he'll end all life on Detrios and Earth. Armed with only their wits and with the modest power of control over reality, our heroes must face Doctor Who's evil double, the megamaniacal scientist who calls himself simply... the Doctor." So
it really pulls you in.
And well, it's a very fun blurb, that's for certain, because you don't know what the heck exactly is going on here until you get into the story. And it doesn't give away too much. It's actually a very good blurb, I think. Sometimes blurbs give away a lot. This one is just enough to intrigue you to find out what the heck is actually talking about. So, yeah, good stuff there. Okay, so, of course, spoilers ahead, so be warned. We will, of course, do our quick synopsis first. We start the story with the Doctor and Benny and Chris trapped in some very strange fictional-like scenarios, and we find out that they are there landing on this artifact in space, which is a result of a bleed of fictional energy from the land of fiction. And if the Doctor doesn't close this, it will get worse and worse, and bad things will happen in the universe. So they'll go there to put pay to the end of this. Unfortunately, This object is referred to as the miracle on the planet underneath it, the planet of Detrios. And they lost all of their energy from the sun's collapse or something along those lines. And so they were slowly dying out, living underground until this miracle appeared. And it provides them with just enough light and energy so that they can eke out an existence on the surface. Of course, with the Doctor ending this miracle, it will also kind of doom the people of Detrios. But for the greater good, of course, the Doctor is out to stop it. However, things aren't going to be quite that simple, because with the fictional energy leaking out of the Land of Fiction, the master of the Land of Fiction, who was not named and we didn't really see a whole lot the last time he appeared in Conundrum, but his name is Jason, and because he has a link to Land of Fiction, he is absorbing the energy as it comes out of the Land of Fiction, and that gives him fictional control of reality. So basically, whatever he wants can kind of happen. And so what he wants is a version of the Doctor to show up. And so he creates a fictional version of the Doctor called Doctor who shows up in the TARDIS, knocks out the Doctor, sends him into this fictional jail that takes the TARDIS to go pick up Jason for them to go on grand adventures. Now, Jason is young. Maybe, I think they mentioned he's like a 16-year-old, but he kind of has a mentality of someone even younger than that. Mostly probably because of his experiences in the Land of Fiction. But
no, he's like 25.
Well, is he that old?
But really, he behaves so much younger than that.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely talk about how his actions belay how old he actually looks. I was always kind of confused on whether he was making himself look older or if he was older but just had like the mind of someone much younger. But I don't know. I mean, 6 1/2 dozen, it doesn't really matter. Basically, he is somebody who has a very black and white mentality. As they say in the book, he's got a very comic book mentality of the world, black and white. They go off on these adventures that he dreams up. Ends up destroying a planet during the course of having a made-up adventure. He has the Trods show up, and they have to go stop them, and unfortunately they end up blowing up the planet that these Trods are invading. Of course, all the people that were made up, but there were indigenous life forms on that planet, and they decide, well, we just got to do better next time. They show up on Detrios, and Detrios has two people on it. It has the humans and then these lizard people. Of course, they don't quite get along, and there's an impending battle about to happen between them. And as the Doctor Who and Jason show up and they convince them, oh, we got these horrible lizards attacking us, the Doctor Who whips up a creation, which is a lizard killer box with a button on it. They push it and it kills off all of the lizards, committing genocide in one fell swoop. But that's okay, at least in Jason's eyes, because they were the monsters. They were green. Obviously, we can just kill them. So obviously, Jason is very has a lot of problems and doesn't quite understand the way the universe works. And so they decide that they, number one, have to stop the Doctor, because the Doctor is the Jason. Jason's mind, the counterpoint to Doctor Who. He's an evil doppelganger. So they take the Doctor there. They track down Benny and take Benny to jail along with him. Roz is able to hide in the TARDIS. Chris gets captured by the natives on Detrios, but the Doctor Who and Jason go save him, and he actually ends up joining with them, because Chris, while he's on the planet, realizes that what the Doctor has done by going and destroying the miracle is going to doom these people. And he kept this from Chris and Benny and everybody else, and now he's quite upset with the Doctor, because the Doctor knew that these people would more than likely die from their actions and kept it from them. So he's not quite happy with the Doctor anymore, especially because he found a little girlfriend while he was there. She was part of the resistance, and he helps her escape, and they seem to have a little thing brewing between them, but he is about to be killed by the religious fanatics on the planet, and then Doctor Who and Jason show up. They save him and talk about how they've already imprisoned the evil Doctor and his accomplices on the prison planet. They actually go and they track down Mel, who has since leaving the Doctor, has drifted the universe with Glitz, got abandoned there, and then she ends up on this resort planet that's actually not a very good resort planet, and she's like trapped there. She can't get off, no way off, and she doesn't know how she's going to get off. She tries to get Glitz to come back and get her, but Glitz just uses her once again to steal money from the bank, and it alerts the authorities, and thankfully she thinks the Doctor shows up to save her, but of course it is just Doctor who is tracking down all of his evil doppelganger's accomplices, and so he takes Mel and takes her to the jail with the Doctor. And so they leave him there, actually thinking that they've inadvertently destroyed them after they try to make a prison break. And the Doctor Who and Jason decide that they have to go to the one place that the Doctor has caused more trouble than anywhere else, which is the planet Earth, and they're going to sort it out. They start off by going to England, and they try to speak with the Queen, but the Queen's not there, so they can't speak to her. And then they try to organize a rebellion, but nobody wants to join them. And they figure out the only thing that they can do is they have to assassinate the Queen. Now, they also had gone back to Earth in an attempt to track down Ace. Unfortunately, Ace ends up being a little bit more than they could handle. Ace, who, you know, last we saw her was back in revolutionary France, and has access to her time hoppers. So she can travel in time about 100 years in the future. She had jumped in time in the future to kind of test it out. And that's when Doctor Who and Jason attacked her. She fights them off in a really cool scene where they're kind of jumping timelines like 30 minutes, hours apart, having this big epic battle. Ace is just beating the hell out of them, giving as good as she gets. And Jason finally decides that he's had enough. He's not going to bother with her anymore, because she's just no fun. And so they leave to go assassinate the Queen. And of course, Ace has to try to track him down, which she does so. And then the Doctor is able to also track them down, and we confront them as they try to assassinate the Queen. They shoot a big giant laser pistol at her, which hits her, but because of Jason's mentality, actually doesn't kill her. It looks really bad. Blood spurts everywhere, but she's not actually dead. But that serves enough for him to go back to Buckingham Palace and decide that Doctor Who is going to be the new king. The Doctor shows up to confront him and explain to Jason, like, look, what you're doing is wrong. You're causing more problems than what you have been able to solve. This power you have is very dangerous. And he's just about to get everything under control when Roz busts in, and she and Benny had met up with UNIT, and actually they had met up with Brigadier Bambara. From Battlefield. They're able to finally break into Buckingham Palace, and this scares Jason, so he kills everybody in a big giant burst of flame. Fortunately, the Doctor at the last second is able to manipulate some fictional energy himself to convince Jason to consider everything that happened to be as a dream. So everybody wakes up after having experienced this big fireball of death, realizing that they've escaped by the skin of their teeth. But there's still a problem with the fact that this miracle is still there, leaking fictional energy, and they've got to take care of it. So they finally go back to the miracle. It has to be the Doctor, Jason, and Ace to go there because, number one, Chris and Benny can't go back because they've already been there once, and their hypnotic suggestions that they had implanted originally to survive there wouldn't work a second time. And two, Roz can't go because she has promised Chris that she will take him back to Detrius to save his little girlfriend before everything goes to hell after the miracle is destroyed. Things don't go as well as planned, unfortunately. The Detrians don't want their miracle to be destroyed, so they send people up there to attack the Doctor. They're able to fight them off, fortunately, and they are able to go and set their little generators off so that they can destroy the miracle. Chris is unable to find his little girlfriend, and he comes to the realization that this has all been kind of a waste, and he kind of has to face the reality of what he does with the Doctor, and it may not always be nice, but sometimes there are greater good things to do. Mel, of course, is not helping out because as the adventure has gone along, she's seen exactly what the Doctor has become and the people he travels with now, and thinks that he is now a horrible horrible person. And this kind of weighs on the Doctor, because after they are finally able to shut down the fictional energy, they're fighting back. When you're on the Miracle, the fictional energy works on you, where your subconscious projects things that you would see, fictional things. And so with these post-hypnotic suggestions, they're kind of going through adventures and things like that. So, you know, Ace has a nice adventure where she's killing aliens and things like that. The Doctor originally has a nice adventure where he's off killing Daleks, but on the way back, his resolve finally cracks, and he is faced with a fictional version of the Sixth Doctor, who is not happy with him because, as is explicitly pointed out in this book, the Seventh Doctor killed the Sixth Doctor because he felt that the Sixth Doctor could not handle it anymore and was on his way to becoming the Veilyard. And if something wasn't going to be done, then they were going to turn to evil. And of course, there were all these things that were happening in the universe that needed to be righted. And the Sixth Doctor was just going around blustering everywhere and doing whatever he wanted to do and making matters worse. So the Seventh Doctor decided he had to step in and take control so that they could start fixing some of the things that had been wrong with the universe. The Sixth Doctor, of course, points out that he's now become as bad as the Veilyard by manipulating his companions and sacrificing things for the greater good, and he's using people like pawns, and this ends up becoming a physical confrontation between them, where it is finally implied that the Seventh Doctor has to kill the Sixth Doctor, the physical version of the Sixth Doctor, in order to get past him and get back to the TARDIS, which he does so. So the Miracle is destroyed. The universe is saved. Detrius is basically in a near panic as their energy source disappears. They all have to go back underground, but fortunately the Resistance is leading things, and they're determined to try to work out a situation where they survive. And we leave them there with some hope that things will be able to be worked out for them, but we don't really know. It's not a very good situation. The Doctor is able to take Jason, Mel, and Ace back to Earth and take them back to their home times, but Mel has had enough. She gives the Doctor quite a tongue lashing, talking about how awful he has become and that she doesn't want to know him anymore because he's just so horrible now, and she storms off. Ace goes after her, but not before giving the Doctor a message from his future self, telling him that he has to sort out Kadiatu Lethbridge-Stewart from the damage that she's been doing along the timeline. The Doctor, you know, turns back to his companions, and you can tell this adventure has worn on him as he is worried about if they trust him anymore or what's going to happen. They all go along with him, and the Doctor says, well, we'll go have a nice little vacation, and he kind of unburdens himself on Benny a little bit. But as everybody goes off to bed, the Doctor realizes that he's got a mission, and, you know, he can't go back on it, or else everything he's done would be for nothing. So instead of going on the vacation he promised everybody, he resets the coordinates so they can go deal with Kadiatu. So, gentlemen, this is quite the heady book. What do we all make of it?
So it was, I really enjoyed this book. It's, you know, going back to, what was the book? This is like a direct sequel to
Conundrum.
Going back to that, It feels really, I mean, you know, I really enjoyed that book, and you get some really good kind of continuation of that, where it was going from there. And it's very witty. There's some really good writing in here. There's one scene where Bernice and Roz are talking about essentially like chaos theory. And I love this scene. Like, of course, that's a huge part of this, like butterflies and all that. And they're talking about it, and it's just kind of like a conversation they have. And they talk about like a soda can that's sitting there, and it's like, if I kick that, it's going to change everything. Ha ha, whatever. And she kicks it, and then the scene ends. But then it goes, and it says 10 minutes later, a bicyclist comes through and rolls over the soda can, which causes him to do this and that. And eventually, the Draconians go to war. And it was just so clever. It was so Douglas Adams-y that is just the part that stuck out in my head. Just in terms of the book itself, I really enjoyed it for little things like that.
Yeah, it's got lots of great ideas in this book. Lots of things to discuss. So, well, what did you make of it, Jeff?
Ashley's right. It does, certain parts of it does do have a real Douglas Adams feel. The Benny's reality, the kind of comic book one, the planet that Mel is stuck on had a very Douglas Adams feel. There's one like that Arthur Dent stuck on in one of the books, I think mostly harmless. So I also had that feel, although it's not pervasive through all the book.
Definitely not through the whole book.
No, because, you know, while funny things happen, it is not a comedy story.
No.
If it were not so well written, it would almost come off as fan fiction because they throw so many things in that would make fans happy. You know, you miss Ace, here's Ace. You miss Mel, someone had to, here's Mel. You know, it's referencing earlier stories, not just the, you know, the previous stories that the Land of Fiction was in, but even other novels, you know, get nods to them. It really was, there was a lot of fan service in here, but it was done so well that it doesn't just come off as something to just hand the fans, hey, here, have fun with this. No, there's actually solid story here, stuff to really sink your teeth into.
Yeah, it does, on a cursory glance, it does read like a, I don't want to say fan fiction, but it definitely reads like a list of items that fans might like to see, where we've got returning companions as a sequel to a popular story, dealing with the Valeyard, having the Six Daughters show back. I mean, all that kind of stuff. It reads like something out of like a fan fiction-y type of story. But I do think you're right. I think that all the material is handled quite well. There's a lot he's doing here, and Lyons is juggling a lot of balls, and under a lesser talent it would be very easy to drop them, but I think he pulls off everything fairly well. I don't know if this is as good as a book as Conundrum, but it's definitely got ideas that, I mean, this is like a central tenement book of the New Adventures because of what it does. It is finally addressing a lot of the questions that people have about the Doctor at this point in time. One of the things that I really like about it is we don't get any sort of definite answer. I kind of feel like Lyons has definite opinions about Doctor Who and the direction of the New Adventures, but I don't know if I can actually tell what they are from this book. He does a great job of both condemning massively the Seventh Doctor, but at the same time making valid explanations and reasons for the way that he is.
Yeah.
And you know, if you put a gun to my head, I couldn't sit there and tell you whether I think he thinks that the direction of the New Adventures is a mistake or if he is on board and with it. You really can't tell. And I don't know if that is a fault of the book for not taking a side or a bit of brilliance in the book for leaving it ambiguous for the reader to decide.
I don't think it's a fault. I really think it's intentional.
I think you're probably right there. It definitely gives a lot to think about, a lot for us to kind of discuss.
Well, and it really at the beginning, it does just kind of throw you in the deep end with all these separate things happening to everybody. And you don't know why it's happening at first, but it's all so interesting that, you know, it's worth waiting until you get the explanation. Oh, this is why this is happening to Benny and this is happening to the Doctor, sure, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it does throw you in media res, definitely, and letting you figure it out and kind of unspooling everything bit by bit. I think that works pretty well. I will be kind of honest. As a, you know, proclaimed fan of the Seventh Doctors and the New Adventures in general, like going back and rereading this, it was actually kind of hard at bits to read because all of the combinations of Seventh Doctor, I mean, it's very hard to dispute. And it makes you kind of question. I think that's the whole point. I think that is really, really good about it, is it does make you question, and it kind of gives you that insight into the Seventh Doctor's psyche that maybe we don't see all that often, and the guilt that lies in there. We'll definitely be playing with that through the end of the line, and it kind of not really starts here, but we definitely have a expression of those feelings and guilt in this story. And I don't know. It's really difficult. Yes, we do get the explanations and we do get the justifications, but it's kind of hard to consider those to be valid, or if just justifications of this is the decision the Doctor has gone with, and he has to stick by those justifications in order to make his decisions mean something.
So how about Jason, the worst companion ever?
Well, I want to actually step back for just a second in relation to that.
Okay.
Because we talked about the fact that this felt like fan fiction, and that's kind of written into the story.
Right, because Jason is doing fan fiction.
With Jason's essentially writing fan fiction as he thinks the Doctor should be.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm actually about halfway through this book, I'm like, holy crap, I'm Jason.
oh, gosh. Like, I'd be proud of that.
Like I'm obviously, hopefully not that bad, but like the kinds of things he writes, I'm like, okay, strangely, I could see myself writing something like that. I hope it's a little better, but there we go. Because I think there's this level of, like, especially in the 90s, there's like this idea of what Doctor Who was. And I think this book was as much, at least part of the book, was as much a kind of a shout out to that as it was anything else. It was basically saying that there was this, like, idea of what Doctor Who was. Other people obviously had different ideas of what Doctor Who as a property or as an entity or maybe even as a character was. And I think this is a great representation of what that might be or what that might mean.
I do love what Lyons is doing with Jason and Doctor Who, because kind of picking up on when we're talking about how we've got a lot of combination of the Seventh Doctor, Jason and the Doctor Who kind of almost validate what the Seventh Doctor is doing, because the Seventh Doctor is living in a complicated universe. There is no 100% right answer in what he does. He has to make those decisions. He has to weigh those odds as far as, you know, the greater good. And it all comes back down to that, like, doing the best you can in an imperfect universe. Because the decisions that Jason wants to make, that Doctor Who want to make, they don't exist in our universe. That is something that only exists in a comic book. I mean, I guess this is kind of weird talking about, we're talking about a fictional universe, top of a fictional universe, but, you know, just bear with us here. But there is no black and white, at least as far as where the Seventh Doctor exists. It's not as easy as that, even though it may have once appeared to be. And that's kind of what the Seventh Doctor is fighting against in his earlier selves. The universe isn't just black and white. You can't just go in and make those decisions like what the Sixth Doctor would do, because even though he's making decisions based on black and white, nothing is black and white. It's all in a shade of gray. And by making absolute decisions, that's what leads you in a path of becoming the Veilyard, as somebody who believes only in absolutes, right? And so I really like that dichotomy that they're playing with here to show us that if taking to an extreme, even though Jason wants to do good, making those extreme black and white decisions lead to more suffering than maybe even what the Seventh Doctor has to do, right?
Well, he also, though, makes very selfish decisions to make himself out to be a hero. And if other people have to die for him to be the hero, he's okay with that. And that sucks.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say this. Jason makes me miss Adric.
Well, I mean, that's
he's that bad of a companion.
And I think he is, if we were to get into Jason's genesis, he is very much a condemnation of a certain type of Doctor Who fan, I'd say. Somebody who is stuck in that idea of a golden age where there is this idea of, oh, the Doctor should always do this, and the enemy should always do this, and there should not be any in-between between that. And Jason is kind of that taken to an extreme. And it's all about what he wants, not what is best for the universe.
Yeah, he's very selfish.
So let's move along, and while we're talking about the kind of judgment of the Doctor, let's talk a bit about Mel, because Mel is the one that comes in, and she is this voice of, I don't know if naivete is the right word. She is somebody who is still stuck in that mindset. Obviously, Mel, as we saw her on TV, was very much this character who was all about right and wrong, and very stuck up and outspoken about it. And then we have her coming in kind of serving as a audience stand in for somebody who maybe was in that kind of viewpoint back when the show was on TV, looking at what the Doctor has become in the new adventures.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but you can almost call Mel a voice of reason.
Would you? Is it a voice of reason, or is it somebody who refuses to look at the way the universe the way that it is? That is looking at the universe with blinders on.
I'm not sure so much she has blinders on to the way the universe is, but she can't see. She can't stand to see the Doctor behaving the way he is now. She thinks he can be better than that. She thinks he can do things different than that. And that he's being unnecessarily cruel. You know, we go back to, you know, the old idea of never cruel or cowardly. This Doctor's being rather cruel.
But is he really being cruel, or is he just making the heart? I mean, I don't think there's anything that we can see from the Seventh Doctor as being cruel. Making hard choices, yes, and making decisions that are going to be hurtful to some in order to, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, right?
Yeah, but that's not the Doctor's attitude through most of his incarnations. You know, the idea, you know, that was especially prevalent under, you know, in the RTD era of today, nobody dies. And in this, you know, pre-war Doctor, pre-RTD, this Doctor is very much willing to let two races die when he takes away the miracle from the sky. You know, there's a small chance they will come up with something
right,
to survive.
Right, but I mean, that's kind of the point there. I mean, there is still a chance.
But yeah, but he doesn't do anything to help them with that. He just says, okay, you're on your own now, figure it out.
But again, you have to look at it from his point of view. The way that the universe has gone, like, you can say that, oh, he's always wanting people to live. But, I mean, if you look at the history of the way the Doctor has gone, I mean, like, that is just a fallacy of belief there. Because whenever he gets involved, people die. It doesn't matter. I mean, people are constantly dying around him. So much to the fact that, I mean, I would never certainly want to become a companion. As much as I loved her too, I would never become a companion. Are you kidding me? I like living too much. There's just no way. But people will die around him all the time. And what the Seventh Doctor says is, this is a result of me going about the universe like carefree and not being concerned with the actions that I make, blundering in and doing the right thing and helping out doesn't necessarily enough. If you go in and plan for it and think ahead, you can try to minimize those disruptions. How, if he gets involved in helping these people and giving them, like, what does that mean for the greater sense of the universe? I mean, it may be nothing, but it may have greater impacts. It's that whole butterfly effect again, right? If he gets involved and something happens that's not supposed to, then how is that going to affect the universe? I mean, that's his whole point of what he, when he talks about, when I was young and I went out and did this and that, oblivious to the way that this had any sort of effect on the universe. Now I'm having to go back and fix it because, you know, going back to that whole butterfly analogy, all the butterflies that he's knocked over across the universe have caused greater problems out there that he now has to go fix. And that's why he has to do what he does. I mean, it's not the nicest viewpoint, and it is contrary to what he's been before, but from that point of view, it is almost understandable. I mean, this is the argument, of course, the book is having, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get an answer which one's right or wrong, but that's the argument.
Yeah, I can see. I can't believe these words are coming out of my mouth. I can see Mel's point of view.
Yes, yes. I mean, and of course, and that's why when she lays into the doctor and things she said, that's why they sting when I read them. Because, yes, she does have a point. But it's one of those things where there's no real answer because, yes, she's right. The doctor should be this way and shouldn't be causing suffering in it. It should be doing whatever he can to help wherever he can. But at the same time, is that the best thing for the universe? There's no answer. It's just, and that's why the Seventh Doctor has to live with the guilt because he knows he should be better, but has to make these decisions because if he doesn't, how much worse can it get? And I guess go ahead.
That's why this book is so good.
Right.
I mean, we talked about, you know, there's some humor to it and that's great, but this is a deep book and there are philosophical questions and the answers are not handed to us.
Right. Whew. I mean, I guess it all comes back to the specter that hangs over this entire book. And that, of course, is the Veilyard, because it is the Doctor being faced with the Veilyard that kind of set all this in motion. Because in the Seventh Doctor's point of view, again, it is the way that he used to act, especially the Sixth Doctor, the way that he is out there just brashly crashing his way through time and space, doing whatever he thinks is right, that leads him to having this point of view that would lead to the Veilyard. And that's why the Seventh Doctor has to step in order to try to avoid that. But then again, we got the Seventh Doctor doing these things that maybe aren't as nice as what the Veilyard would do. I mean, I don't know. I mean, he does all sorts of things that cause death and destruction around, inadvertent or not, or for the greater good for the whole universe to survive, and using his friends and companions. I mean, and that's kind of like the biggest thing is the way that he treats his companions.
The greater good is such a slippery slope, though. And I recently rewatched an episode of the Star Trek, the original series, The Conscience of the King. And that's the one with Kodos, the executioner, who, when Captain Kirk wasn't Captain Kirk, he was an 8-year-old boy, killed half the population of a colony so the other half could live. Was he doing it for the greater good? He thought so. But history brands him as a terrible criminal. And you kind of wonder, you know, at this point, you know, granted, we know the Doctor's going to go on. But at this point, you wonder, how is history going to treat the Doctor? Is he going to be a hero for what he does? Or, you know, even if he makes the repairs to time and, you know, prevents himself from ever becoming the Veilyard, will he still be looked at as a criminal down the line? Because of the way he's doing things.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, it's one of those questions with no real answer, at least not as far as this book goes or what, mm-hmm. what Doctor Who gives us. And it's, of course, something that will be debated until we're no longer on this planet, I'm sure. It's just something that we'll never really be able to go again. And I think that's kind of where the Seventh Doctor finds himself at that crossroads of how do I do the right thing, knowing what I know and the things that I've done in the past, and as I try to prepare for the future. I certainly don't envy what the Seventh Doctor has to face, that's for certain. And then to realize that everything that he's done he kind of, as he has his conversation with the fictional Sixth Doctor, he puts forth that, you know, everything that he has done in the pursuit of not becoming the Baleyard, as far as stopping that path that he saw himself as being on, and then where he has to come to realize that he's not escaped that. He's just as dangerous now and capable of becoming the Baleyard as he was under Colin Baker. I mean, it's just that's almost heartbreaking just to realize that he's got all this guilt and all the horrible things he's had to do to try to avoid this fate and do the right by the universe, and yet it still may not have absolved him of that. Yeah, it's just like you can't help but feel bad for him. I mean, Mel can yell at him all she wants to, but at least I don't know if we get the sense of perspective from seeing into his mind and the guilt that is there. I feel bad for him. Just a horrible burden.
It's a burden. He has this terrible responsibility that he can't just hand off, and he wouldn't if he could, because he's still a responsible person.
Right. I mean, and of course, the real tragedy of it is being aware of this and knowing that he could make different decisions. In the end, he goes back to his mission and does what he thinks he has to do. I mean, and of course, that's the real tragedy of the ending of the book. Pretty powerful, I'll be honest.
Yeah.
Whew. You want to weigh on that, Ashley? We've been kind of going back and forth. Where do you fall in this spectrum? Is Mel right?
Yeah, it's really difficult to kind of go through. I mean, you can definitely, as you guys said, you can definitely see her point of view. But I also find it interesting that this isn't, like, her point of view isn't that much different than what Ace had said in the past.
Sure.
It was done a little differently in terms of the way it was presented, and it's kind of interesting to see Ace now come in and go like, yeah, it's the Doctor. You just deal with it.
What are you going to do?
And so it's...
I mean, you see Ace almost sorry for Mel as she... I mean, she recognizes what Mel's going through, you know, realizing this.
Well, and I think that actually shows a lot of growth in Ace.
Ace is great in this book, I felt.
And you get to see her kind of going like, yeah, it sucks. You just have to take the Doctor for what he is. And, you know, he means well. You know,
but I mean,
you know,
of course, from Mel's point of view, she would say, well, what has the Doctor done to you, Ace, that you now accept this, you know?
Well, yeah, and we also have to understand that Mel had only met Ace once.
Right.
I mean, I do think that was kind of, like, taken kind of abruptly. It wasn't really brought out. I mean, she didn't really know Ace. But it does bring out, you know, and the Doctor kind of references this later. He does turn his companions into villains, or not villains, but...
Weapons
and those kinds of things. And I mean, that's a theme that runs through the new series.
Even. Sure. Oh yeah. That gets brought up time and time again.
So that's not it's not something that we just see in these books. He does do that. And I think he wishes he didn't have to do that. You know, but he has this burden, and I think that's the interesting, I think that's a fun thing that we see in this. He has this burden of responsibility and I think he even says that to some extent.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this, well, you don't understand. You don't understand the responsibility that I have to do. If I don't do this, like, the universe, you know, he's the person keeping chaos theory in check. He's the one making sure that the butterfly flaps its wings at the right time. And he's like, you were, you know, when he's talking to the Sixth Doctor, He's saying you were reckless. You were reckless for getting involved and getting involved in the wrong way. You have to be more stealthy than that. You have to plan. You have to do this. You have to have weapons. And sometimes those weapons are your companions or your friends. I love every one of them, but I can't be responsible for what happens to them because in the end, I'm saving millions as opposed to one or two people care dearly for. And I think Mel is kind of like, well, that's not the Doctor. I mean, the Doctor would, would go in, and if there was an injustice, you would make sure, no matter what it took, you would make sure that injustice was dealt with proper.
No, and I mean, again, I think Mel as a character is made to be much more Pollyanna about that situation. And I mean, I don't think she's really looking with a full comprehension of the situation. I mean, like, yes, the doctor when she was with, you know, the sixth doctor would go in and do the best they could. But I mean, let's not forget. I mean, like, he commits genocide and killing the Vervoids. And
well, let's talk a different point of that too. We see Mel at the beginning without the doctor, without Glitz, without the doctor. And she's not really the character that we had seen before either.
No, she's had some growth.
She's had, she has kind of been on her own. She's talking about like having affairs, and that's something that she would never have done in the character that we knew. So we kind of, now many times it might be out of necessity, but that's not the kind of character that we were presented with Mel. So she's changed too. So it's almost like she's willing to see the change in herself, but unwilling to see the change in someone else. So it actually says a lot about Mel also, because her, I'm not going to say her moral compass is wrong, but her moral compass has changed.
Well, I mean, and of course, I think it probably also has something to do with holding the doctor up on a pedestal. I mean, obviously, he is this larger-than-life figure, and she's got this idea of him, and to have it dashed, I mean, it would be pretty disheartening. So I think she was with him up to the point when he comes clean and tells her, yeah, I sent you away from me. It wasn't your decision to leave me. I made you leave, which I think would be pretty shattering, especially where she ends up. And so she kind of blames him because, yes, she became different. She made these other decisions, and it wasn't actually her real fault. She did what she had to do after the doctor made her leave. And I think she kind of blames him for that as well, and kind of justifiably.
Sure. Yeah. And that does make sense.
I love finding that out. It puts Paige to a great reason for her awful leaving in Dragonfire, because that's just an awful, I mean, like, it's a cool little scene, but it makes zero sense. And to have that put in here is very fitting as far as explaining her awful departure there. I also like the point where she's come face to face with Ace and asked her, like, how many people you've killed. And of course, Ace knows exactly how many she's killed. It's like 400 and something. Just like, it just leaves in shock. this little girl that she had found and now has killed over 400 people. So it's just, I don't really like Mel in the story, but it's every time that she's on page and we're getting this condemnation, the way that she's viewing not just the doctor but everybody that he travels with, to the point where, like, Benny decides I'm over you and, like, points out the fact that she, yeah, I got a gun, what are you gonna do about it? It's just like, poor Mel, what have you gotten yourself into? You're just not made for this story, are you?
Well, and oddly enough, I did like Mel in this story because she isn't, she has a reason to be contrary. So many times she seems to be contrary just to be contrary. And this time she has what I think is a legitimate reason for doing so. Maybe she's right, maybe she's wrong, but at least it seems to have conviction behind it.
No, and I agree with you. And maybe saying I dislike her is the wrong thing to say. It's more of not being comfortable with what she's saying, maybe. Maybe that's more on the lines of, it's like when you're in a room with one of those people who are just absolutely assured that they're right and they don't want to hear any other argument to the contrary, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but having to deal with them can sometimes be a chore. And even if they're right, and that, I guess that's kind of what I'm getting from Mel in this story. It's not that I'm not liking her. It's just, I guess, shining a light on those areas that maybe we don't want to have shined on, I suppose, when we look at the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's turn to
Oh man, I had a great joke and my microphone was muted. It's probably better, to be honest with you. So I'll let that one go.
You can't bring it up and not lay it on us. So just put it out there.
I said, oh, so Mel's a River Song fan.
Yeah. Dun, 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 dun. All right, moving on. Let's talk a little bit about Chris. Now, Chris has been, I think the new companion that hasn't been as well defined. I mean, Roz, we get a pretty clear idea of who she is and what she's all about. That was established pretty fairly early on. But Chris, he's always been kind of this good-looking pretty boy, naive, kind of milquetoast, if we're being honest, who's just kind of been along for the ride and the adventure. And we really haven't got a sense of him. But I think this is the first story that we've really gotten to really get into who he is. And I'll be honest with you, at least at this point in time, I don't know if I really like him that much. He's so, I don't know, square is the right word, but...
Well, yeah, you're accusing Mel of being Pollyanna.
Yeah.
Chris is the one that's really a Pollyanna.
This is true. But I think at least Chris is... He doesn't know what to think. Mel has made up her mind and doesn't want to brook any argument. Chris, at least, is open to it. And he's kind of... He's wishy-washy throughout the course of the book. And I think that's kind of where... The problem, not like a problem, but where the issue that he has during the course of the book, as we see him kind of struggling with what he believes. I mean, obviously the doctor has lied to him and he doesn't like that, but as he looks on with what Roz is doing and what Roz has said, he really looks to her for guidance. And of course, she believes 100% what the doctor was doing, the good little soldier, because that's the way that she's thinking. You know, it's a matter of numbers. She's a soldier, a matter of numbers. The more people you help, it doesn't matter if somebody, the lower number is hurt in the way, as long as you're helping more people than what you're hurting. And that's a very soldier-like mentality. And so Chris is kind of stuck in between that point of view of being somebody who wants to look for the best and do the best for everybody, and then having to look at what Roz believes and kind of having to come to a decision as far as what his place on the TARDIS is. And while I think it is a good story to see, it's kind of like, come on, just man up, Chris. That's just the kind of the way that I felt. Even though I think it was a valid journey for him.
No argument. I don't have anything to add. That sounds good to me. When he's in his dreamscape, when he's being pursued by the nightmare version of Roz, let's say, and he shouts out that he loves her. Do you really think he meant that, or was it just a tactic to break her concentration?
I don't know. I mean, I think what we're supposed to take away from this is just how, like, young and unaware of the realities of the world that Chris is. He is... you know, he hadn't been an adjudicator very long when he started out, and he was a firm believer. He was, you know, one of those the way they always portray the rookie cops on TV. He gets faced with all the corruption and the realities of the way that the system works, all that kind of stuff, yada yada yada.
And he hasn't been broken down yet.
Right. And so this is where we really start to see him get broken down and faced with the realities of the situation. I mean, it's kind of sad in a way. But at the same time, you're like, come on, get it over with. Face up with the way the world really works, Chris. Make a decision. But I mean, I think it was necessary for him in order for us to kind of be able to follow him going forward in the future. Because like I said, at this point in time, like, we really didn't have a sense of who he is. Now we've got a sense of who he is, and hopefully it develops more from there. Spoilers, I think it does. He's not the greatest of characters, but I really like Chris, so... Unfortunately, what this means is we don't have a lot of Benny in this book.
There was such a large cast.
I know. So it's hard to have a whole lot of any meaningful stuff with Benny. I mean, she gets some good one-liners, of course, and she's in there and working with Roz and bantering with the unit people and things like that. But she does get one key point that I really, really enjoyed, and it's the fact that out of everybody the Doctor has alongside him, it's Benny that he kind of unloads to. It's Benny is the one that he is able to be honest with and voice what's going on and kind of makes her the truest companion that he has, because they've gotten past all that stuff and he can be honest, you know, at least honest as the Doctor can be with her. And I find that to be Benny points out how moving it is almost to her that she realizes that he's opened up to her rather than anybody else. And I think that's a very good moment in her and the Doctor's relationship.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't do much of anything else, but I really like that moment. Just to
I do like the kind of banter with her and Bombera, where she's like, I'm here too. You can talk to me. I'm capable. I don't know. I enjoy that.
No, I mean, she gets all like the best little one-liners. Again, the book isn't anywhere near as like humorous as...
Well, in a way, she was comic relief in this book.
Sure.
Which is, I mean, all right, I guess. I mean, because most of her stuff was kind of the more humorous bit.
Pursuing the quiz across Metro City.
Yeah.
Or should we say that Metrocity?
Right.
Metrocity.
No, the little fictional landscapes they find herself in, hers was always pretty amusing as she basically was facing off against the Riddler and going from really horrible riddles that have no real solutions.
It was 1966 Batman right. Level of riddles. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Nothing wrong with that.
No?
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. I you know, comic book guy, I enjoyed the sequences.
Yeah.
Even if I didn't know what was going on at first.
Now, yeah. Jeff, you didn't read the last novel that this is kind of a sequel to, did you?
Was it Conundrum? No.
Yeah. No, I didn't think so. So it probably didn't make as much sense to you.
Well, you've seen The Mind Robber.
Did the quiz have a previous appearance? Or are you just talking about the land of fiction in general?
Just the way it was presented in this book is like the way it was presented in that book.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, idea is the Mind Robber, but there was stuff directly from that book that kind of, like, carried over.
I mean, Jeff could answer. Did it really throw you off? I don't think there was really a whole lot that you really needed to know.
No, in fact, it wasn't until after I read the book and then I was doing some research, you know, behind the scenes kind of stuff that I found out it was a sequel to two previous stories. I'm like, oh, okay.
Right.
You don't have to know those previous stories to enjoy this book.
Yeah, that's true. I thought so,
too. And plus, you know, we're talking about such a huge cast. I don't think you have to know these characters from previous novels either. You get a good sense of who they are, you know, even if it is brief, you know, like you're talking about, you know, you felt like Benny wasn't in a lot. Well, yeah, it's because she's one of like seven main characters, but I still think they were all served well enough that you didn't have to know everything about them from before. You didn't have to know anything about them from before. This would actually be a decent jumping on point.
Sure. I mean, like, it pretty much sets the tone for the new adventures, and it covers pretty much all of the main themes that the new adventures have been dealing with up to this point. I mean, you probably lose a little bit of nuance here and there from being familiar with, like, Ace's journey and what Benny's had to go through and that sort of thing. But, I mean, it still is a very good, solid idea of what – here's what the new adventures have been up to at this point in time. Here's what we're dealing with going forward as far as who the characters are, at least thematically.
Well, to go off on a bit of a tangent, I took my kids to see the Goosebumps movie this past weekend. And the Goosebumps series started just after I was old enough – that I wouldn't be reading them. So I don't have any association with the monsters from those books. And I'm sure there were all kinds of references in that movie to, stuff, you know, dads that would be a little younger than me would have been getting, oh yeah, I remember this monster. I remember this monster. I remember this monster. I didn't get any of that. I still enjoyed it. It's a good movie.
Yeah.
But, and that's my point. I still enjoyed it even though I didn't know all the references. And the same thing applies here. I didn't have to know everything that may have been presented before. It was still a good enough story that you don't have to know that. I love this author. He's so good.
Indeed. All right. Well, does anybody have any final thoughts before wrapping it up, or should we just go into what we thought and rate it?
I think we're good.
All right. Yeah. Let's rate it. Go ahead.
All right. Well, you know, I was going to give it a 4.5, but after having talked about it for the better part of an hour, I'm going to give it a 5. I really enjoyed the heck out of this book. I do recommend that people go ahead and search this out, find it, read it. Ignore the ugly cover.
Well, New Adventure covers, I mean, you just... though I will say, the New Adventure cover for next month is probably the best bit of art ever been done for Doctor Who, but that's just me.
All right, so what do you guys think?
Yeah, so I think I'll go with a 4 with this. I really enjoyed the book. I had a lot of fun with kind of revisiting the land of fiction and some of the ramifications of that. And seeing where some of those characters are. I think this was a really introspective story in terms of kind of, it was self-referential in terms of fandom and those kinds of things. So I think that was a fun thing to experience as well, seeing that element of fandom. It also gives us a snapshot of fandom through the eyes of fiction, I think, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is really interesting, really fun. So yeah, I think a solid four.
Yeah, I think this is hard to rate for me. Just as much as it was hard to read, that it's good. I think a 4. I'm gonna go with a 4 as well. I think that the bits on Detrios were boring as all get out, and just took away from what I wanted to be reading. And every time we went back there, I was like, oh my god, I'm back here again. Can we please go find out what's going on with Jason or what's going on with the doctor? Something. But once we got away from those bits, it's such an engrossing read to see what the doctor is having to face, at least on his subconscious level, on a daily basis, as he deals with decisions that he's made over the years and as the Times champion. Just seeing the thematic debate as far as who is right, he or the sixth doctor or Mel and the seventh doctor. It is just a brilliant observation on the seventh doctor. And again, doesn't force any one interpretation down your throat. You can look at it either way. It's both points of view are equally valid, I think. And both their points are made very, very well. So, I do like the 4. It's got a great action sequence with Ace fighting in multiple time zones against the Doctor Who and Jason. It's got a fantastic scene with the Doctor and Mel on a train as the Doctor is pointing out his methods to her as he tries to get the train to go faster, whether by upgrading the train or doing better time schedules that he's going to have to remember to go back and do in the future. and just the revelation of what he did to Mel to make her leave, and just so many great ideas to chew on in here. And I mean, I don't feel like we've even scratched the surface of all the stuff going on in this book. So yeah, I definitely think it is a good solid 4, if nothing else. Okay, what about his head games? Why don't we quickly, because we spent a good amount of time on that, let's quickly wrap up talking about our novel adaptations. We talked about All Consuming Fire last time, at least Ashley and I did. So if you want to quickly touch on, I know you've had a chance to listen to it now, Jeff. What did you make of the audio adaptation of All Consuming Fire?
Well, you know, it's funny. We talked a little bit about Head Games seeming a bit like fan service. The All Consuming Fire is a lot of fan service. I really enjoyed the parts more than the sum.
Interesting.
You know, I love everyone that's in it. You know, I love Sylvester. I love Sophie, Lisa, and, you know, Nick Briggs as Sherlock Holmes. If you listeners have not listened to any of the Nick Briggs Sherlock Holmes stories, you really should. He is terrific. As the detective, and this may not be the best introduction for that. You know, if you're looking for a Doctor Who story to get into Sherlock Holmes, okay, but it really, it didn't, it didn't serve me that well as a total story. Seemed like it jumped around a lot, you know, looking for reasons to separate the leads from their companions. You know, I did enjoy it a lot, and it's a lot of fun to listen to. It just wasn't the great story I was hoping for.
That's too bad. I don't know. I guess maybe it was just touching all of the right fan service for me. And again, I really like the way that it presents itself as far as being an audio story, and the way it just adapts itself so well to being a phenomenal audio story. I've always thought, keep in mind,
I haven't read the prose version. I'm just basing it on the audio itself.
Sure. But yeah. The performances, I think, were great. I've always thought that the story's ending needed a little bit of work, because it kind of has a very abrupt ending. So in that situation, it is kind of a letdown as far as like where it really succeeds is in the world building and the audio adaptation, the performances of our main characters. The story is always kind of taking a backseat to showing the Doctor and Sherlock interact in this world, and then throwing in the Cthulhu myth of something. That's where the strength of the story lies.
I think that was part of the problem for me, is that it was almost too much, because we have Doctor Who, and that's great, and Sherlock Holmes, and that's great, and Cthulhu, which, you know, like I've talked about before, Portland area is a big Cthulhu fan base area, but it was like one thing too many, you know.
I can understand that.
Pick two.
The thing is I love my Seventh Doctor being involved on this grand cosmic scale with, you know, greater beings from the dawn of time. That is my absolute jam when it comes to Doctor Who.
Yeah, well, and I've enjoyed those stories too, but then you'll also have Holmes. And I would rather have had a Doctor and Holmes, I guess, with a proper mystery.
I mean, I can understand that. I mean, I definitely see where you're coming from, because, I mean, it is, it could always be looked at as just a hair too much by throwing in extra stuff. I don't know. It's just, I guess if you're going to go throw in Sherlock and Doctor Who together, you know, might as well go the whole hog, right? I don't know.
Well, they certainly did.
Yeah.
Well,
what would you rate it then, Jeff?
Despite my problems, like I said, it is a ton of fun, though. It is a ton of fun. So I'm still going to give it a 4.
Yeah, I think that's a good solid rating. All right. We still need to cover Theater of War. I know Ashley hasn't had a chance to listen to it yet because of his bohemian lifestyle. and we've run over long here talking about Head Games, so I think we'll save that for next time.
That sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, and so we'll go ahead and wrap it up here. Ashley, if the good people at home want to get in touch with us, how can they do so?
If you'd like to get in touch with us and talk to us about this story or any story we've talked about in the past or maybe talking about in the future, you can do so by giving us an email at theoncomingstormpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter. You can find Josh at @TheOncomingJosh, and you can find me at Izlear. That's Izlear. You can also find us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/TheOncomingStormPodcast. That is where we talk about a lot of the stories that we talk about, and lots of conversation going on there. And finally, you may have called us. You may be listening to us from iTunes. You can find us there, and we would love for you to give us a listen there, or a rating there, rather. I'm all off on Bohemian today, apparently. I was going great, and then it just fell apart.
Ah, that's okay. I don't know it by now. All right, so that does it for Head Games. Folks, in 4 short weeks, we'll be back to talk about the best Doctor Who book ever written. And that is going to be The Also People by Ben Aronovitch. If anybody disagrees with me, they are more than welcome to do so at their peril. Anyway, going forward from there, we're actually entering in a great stretch of books. We've got to deal with an Uncle Terrence book after that. But then we come back shortly after that for the second best Doctor Who book ever written. When we'd be talking about Lance Parkin's debut. So,
Are we already at Longbarrow?
No. We do have.
We're going back to Nightshade.
No. All right. We'll talk about that when the audio comes out in April. But good times coming up in the new adventures as we hit the home stretch as far as what Virgin was doing, and so much goodness coming up ahead of us. So be sure to join us in a month for that. In 2 weeks' time, we're going to take a break for a month on the new releases from Big Finish to give everybody a chance to catch up. So we're going to go back in time and talk a little bit about the Fourth Doctor, which we haven't actually talked a whole lot about here on this podcast. So we're going to look at the Hinchcliffe box set that came out about a year and a half ago. And we'll be talking about that in 2 weeks. As well, of course, our next two Big Finish stories, and we're actually entering into we're kind of exiting the Big Finish doldrums and heading into a better age, and we get to talk about the Kingmaker, one of my favorite audios ever.
Oh, good one.
Next time, so look forward to that, folks. Until then, thank you all for listening. And of course, thank Jeff and Ashley for being here with me tonight.
Thanks for having us, Josh.
Always a pleasure. So we'll see everybody in 2 weeks. Until then, take care.
We'll see you soon.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone.
You have been listening to The Oncoming Storm, a Doctor Who spinoff media podcast. All thoughts and opinions are solely those of the host and do not represent those of Mad Norwegian Press, the Timegate Convention, or any other organizations they manage to worm their way into. Contact us at theoncomingstormpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook. Be sure to like our page on Facebook to get all of the latest information on the show. Get new episodes through iTunes or at our website, www.theoncomingstorm.libsyn.com.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek. Classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.